Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Adam Corner of the Climate Outreach and Information Network. He's the research director at COIN and also writes regularly for the national media, including The Guardian, New Scientist and The Ecologist. He's going to talk to us today about COIN, what it is and its aims and objectives. Hello, Adam. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hi, Barry. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
OK, can we maybe start by you telling us a bit about your background and how you got involved with COIN?
Yeah, sure. So my background is in psychology. I did a psychology degree and then I did a psychology PhD, which at the time had nothing at all to do with climate change. It was about how people evaluated evidence in general. So when they're presented with a new argument or something that they might read in the newspaper, what was it about that information that changed their mind or affected their opinions, or did it affect their opinions and why? So I was interested in I guess kind of persuasion and the psychology of persuasion in a very general way. And as my PhD progressed, I became more and more interested externally to that in the issue of climate change and realized how important it was. And I realized at some point that those two things could come together in a useful way, and that actually, you know, the psychology of how we think about ourselves, the future, and how we respond to risks and how we think about new information, does it affect our existing opinions, that was all really relevant to engaging people on climate change. And I became, you know, very interested in why some people accepted climate change, other people didn't. Was it a lack of information? If it wasn't information, then what was it about climate change that seemed to be so difficult for people to connect with? And so that's kind of how I came to the issue, really.
And how did you get involved with COIN?
I think the first time I got involved with COIN was George Marshall, who's the founding director of COIN, and he's still with COIN now as director of projects. George got in touch after he read something that I wrote for The Guardian, which was, I think, in fact, I know exactly when it was, because it was just after Barack Obama had been elected the first time round. And he was talking a good talk on climate change. He's since perhaps gone a bit quieter than people might have liked him to, but at the time he was making a lot of noise that he was going to take climate change seriously. And I wrote a piece that basically said that the missing piece in the puzzle in terms of taking action on climate change, if you're serious about it as the president of the United States of America, is understanding the psychology of how people think about this issue, so we can have all the policies in the right place, all the technologies in the right place, but without getting into the psychology of it and why people do and don't think it's a big issue or think they should respond to it, then it's only half the problem.
Right. I think we'll come back to that later, actually, something that Barack Obama said, but maybe we could start about the issue of climate change itself, which is arguably the most important and urgent issue of our time. Your colleague, George Marshall, who you've just mentioned, suggests that climate change is a perfect and undetectable crime everyone contributes to, but for which no one has a motive. Could you explain what he means by that?
Yeah, so I think climate change is in many ways unique in the sense that it's as a risk issue, it's something that we find really difficult to get our heads around, and that's for lots of different reasons, I think. And one of those is that there isn't an obvious enemy, an other to point to and to say this problem is their fault, we need to put a stop to whatever it is that they're doing, and that will be the answer to the problem. And I think a lot of issues that people are able to take more seriously and think about, like terrorism or something like that, do have an obvious enemy which people can position themselves in opposition to. Whereas, although you can kind of plausibly argue that the fossil fuel industry and the extraction of fossil fuels is at source is the cause of climate change, so we might want to say that maybe the energy companies are the bad guys, the people that speculate and make money from the extraction of fossil fuels are the bad guys. But at the same time, and you find this in research that we've done at COIN, that idea quickly unravels in people's minds, although they might reach for that explanation initially, they then quickly turn in on themselves and say, well, actually, we're all implicated in some senses in this. We all use energy. It's very difficult to step outside of it. And I think that's one of the reasons it has been so difficult for people to get to grips with. If you think of something like smoking and the fight to reduce the amount of smoking that people do, and other sort of health-based campaigns, although it's really tough, and smoking is an addiction, and I don't want to for a second suggest that it's been an easy fight against smoking, it's in some ways it's a single issue. You can identify it, you can draw a line around it, you can see a threat that's personal and direct to you. There's actions that you can take as an individual that will resolve the problem. And none of those features are present with climate change. Like, the responsibility for the problem is dispersed. The impacts of it are dispersed as well. And there isn't anything that we can do that's personal and direct to address the problem. So people talk about that as the psychological distance that's really at the heart of climate change for a lot of people, especially in nations such as the UK, where at the time being we don't experience huge amounts of extreme weather, and so there's not even those sort of perceptual cues to trigger us in thinking about it most of the time.
Yeah. So is that focus then, more the psychological approach, does that make you different than, say, the other environmental pressure groups such as Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. So while we completely support the work that a whole range of organisations do on climate change and environmental issues, we often try and get across to people that in some ways we're not an environmentalist group. It's not that we don't care about the natural environment or protecting polar bears or natural habitats and things like that, but we're trying to start from people, basically. So we're saying that climate change is first and foremost a problem that is caused by people, but also one that will be solved by people, and it's one that affects human societies. So without trying to undermine it for a second the work that organizations like WWF or Friends of the Earth do, we're trying to almost break climate change out of the sort of niche that it's fallen into through historical accident as much as anything, I think, really, because you know, climate change, the climate is something environmental, the climate is changing, you can see where those links are, but it's also about the economy, it's about the food that we eat, it's about the jobs that we do, it's about equality, it's about human rights, it's about so many different things that aren't typically considered environmental. I think a lot of the work that we do is to try and breathe a bit of life into climate change in those different ways, trying to sort of broaden out the social reality of climate change so that it isn't just confined to something that only people who support Friends of the Earth should be interested in, because while that's an important aspect of it, and plenty of people do support organisations like that, it's still a really small number and nowhere near the sort of critical mass you'd need to get to grips with a problem that's as all-encompassing as climate change.
I can imagine it's very easy to be pigeonholed in that niche. How is COIN faring in that regard? Do you think people have that perspective of the organisation, that it's targeting a lot broader, bigger picture?
Yeah, I think what's interesting about COIN is that depending on who you speak to, people have very different ideas about what the organisation does. And I think that partly does reflect the fact that we have done a lot of different things over the years. So we've often been quite close to the sort of forefront of changes in engaging the public on climate change. So if you go back maybe 6 years, 7 years or something like that, when the organisation was still quite young, there was still a real kind of clamour amongst lots of different groups of the public for factual information about climate science, basically. You know, what is this thing, climate change? What do you mean, greenhouse gases? Those terms were not in popular usage as much as they are now. People maybe weren't as familiar with carbon dioxide, things like that. So we used to run sessions for people to literally just learn more about the underlying facts of climate change. These days we do very little on that front, and we have tried to broaden out what we do away from kind of communicating about climate change, the science per se, and more about, it's almost the sort of social science of communicating with people about climate change, and that's much more of a focus of a lot of the work that we do now. I mean, I should say as well, there's another side to the organisation which I personally don't have all that much to do with, which is the defending rights side of COIN, which is basically where we do a lot of work around how environmental changes affect the movement of people and migration in response to climate change. And we've always, I mean, I guess the thing that ties those two things together is the focus on people, you know, rather than just the climate, the environment as something distinct from people and the people that live in it.
Well, in this regard, how crucial is engaging people in Paris 2015 after the failure of the Copenhagen talks 5 years ago?
Copenhagen was such a major event, I think, in the minds of people who work in the field of climate change, particularly. It was billed as, you know, the last chance to save the world, and you can see why campaigns took that angle at the time, because there was a need to really whip up a sense of urgency around climate change. Not that it isn't urgent, it's certainly not a lie to be whipping up a sense of urgency, but because people didn't feel frightened or scared or worried about the effects of climate change, a lot of campaigns around that time were really trying to inject that sense of urgency. And of course, what happened is that, well, not all that much happened. There certainly wasn't the global binding agreement that campaigners and a lot of policymakers as well hoped there would be. And in a sense, everyone's energies just fell off a cliff after Copenhagen had finished. It was billed as a kind of a definite endpoint. And in the same way that when people that predict the end of the world wake up the next morning and find it hasn't happened, there's that sense of thinking, OK, we were told this was the day to save the world and nothing much happened. So I think there's a lot to learn from that for campaigns this time round. And so Paris, the round of negotiations at the end of 2015 are effectively the next point at which serious, substantial decisions can be made, you know, to play a bit of catch up from last time. And obviously the clock's ticked on again since then. So in some ways it's even more urgent. But I think that campaigners do seem to have learned from the last time around. And the umbrella organisation that represents a lot of charities that campaign on climate change in the UK is called the Climate Coalition. They used to be called Stop Climate Chaos. And they approached COIN a while ago, about 6 months ago, to help them put together their campaign strategy, basically, and the kind of themes and language they would use this time around. And what we did was to do audience research. We spoke to different groups of members of the public, which included people who would describe themselves as conservatives politically, who are of interest to organisations like COIN, because there is quite a strong link between political conservatism and scepticism about climate change. Yep. So because scepticism is higher in that group, there's a real question, you know, what is it about climate change that people with centre-right political beliefs don't get on with, and how is there a way of thinking about communicating with that audience more effectively? We also spoke to trade unions, supporters of NGOs, and we basically ran a series of discussion groups where we talked to them about different ways of framing climate change messages, different narratives about climate change. And the idea that was most popular across the different groups was that climate change affects lots of different things which people are passionate about, which people love. And so the slogan that the Climate Coalition have gone with now is to protect climate change for the love of, and then people insert the thing that they're passionate about there. And they seem to be going down quite well, that campaign. And there's a really good website and a video that's been made alongside it, which I think is really starting to apply some of the social science, psychological evidence that COIN tries to get out into the world on how to engage the public more effectively on climate change. So it's, you know, it's trying to link it to people's lives a bit more of a kind of personal, tangible feel to it. And it's putting forward kind of diverse voices, not one narrow band of environmentalists that are only interested in, you know, polar bears or something like that. So it's trying to broaden it out in that sense as well. Yeah. You know, and it's getting to a good positive emotion of love and passion and things to protect, you know, and secure, rather than, I don't know, kind of guilt and fear for things that you haven't done or should have done. It feels like a more stable platform, and it's definitely a more evidence-based platform to be on, I think, for kind of engaging the public around the next set of talks. And that's their slogan running up to the next set of talks in Paris.
Oh, it sounds very encouraging, actually, Adam. Now, you suggest, well, in a recent article, you suggested three ideas for re-inspiring public support. The first one is striking the right balance between bright siding and apocalypse. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, sure. So bright siding is the rather marketing-y term that's been used to sort of putting a positive spin or perspective on climate change, basically. So, you know, for a long time, especially going right back to early, say, maybe Greenpeace campaigns, I think, you know, we can all remember the images of sort of burning globes and things like that. They were quite apocalyptic.
Yeah.
And focused on, you know, the end of the world and doom and gloom, and often linked to quite sort of guilt-based messages about if we don't do X, Y, and Z, then we're going to end up with this, you know, apocalyptic world that no one can live in. And people have learned over time through hard experience, but I think also through a lot of research that's been done around this issue, that isn't necessarily a good way to get through to people. That the kind of kickback against that has almost gone too far in the opposite direction, though, I think, which is that there's been a real push to say, you know, climate change is going to make everything better, which I, you know, I don't think is true. It'd be nice if it was true, but I don't think it is true. There's going to be some real challenges to face. At the very least, there's the biggest sort of coordinated transition we've ever faced, and we're facing it as a global society, not a local village or a nation. You know, to move from a source of energy that has powered us through the Industrial Revolution to new sources of energy that shouldn't mean that our quality of life is affected in a drastic way, but will mean that we have to rethink a lot of things, and it's going to have knock-on effects to every aspect of our lives. And to sort of pretend that there won't be any you know, real challenges in there, I think, is to be misleading, really. So the bright siding on the extreme is not useful, because it's misleading.
Yeah.
And it's not painting an accurate picture. The doom and gloom stuff on the other side is also, I think, not true in the extreme senses, because, like, the world isn't going to end. Whatever we do to it, we might do some terrible things to ourselves as a species and the planet as a whole, but I think, you know, we're not really going to cause global apocalypse in the way that some of those images suggested. But in the middle is the reality, and I think in the middle is actually more satisfying as well. You know, there's challenges to face. There'll be some sectors of the economy in fossil fuel heavy industries that are going to have to face a transition away from those jobs at the moment. That doesn't mean there won't be other jobs, but they are going to have to face changes that can't be avoided. It's not everyone's going to become richer or something like that from climate change, which you wouldn't, you might get that idea from reading some of the more bright-sided economic reports, which I think are coming from a good place. They're trying to say, hey, it's not so bad, you know. Yeah. Things might not be as bad as you think, but they've maybe gone a little bit too far. So it's kind of in the middle there is the right place to be, I think, both in terms of being honest and in terms of actually having a bit of substance to speak to people with about it.
So it's like sort of navigating a middle way between being scared and being soothed, in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And the span of human emotions that come in between it, you know, that's where the kind of richness of human experience is. I think we mostly don't exist at those extremes. So there's so much to explore in the middle, and the different kind of meanings that climate change could have socially to people, that I think is much more promising and fertile ground than just shouting at people that it's the end of the world or telling them it's going to be okay.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then the second one was redoubling efforts to engage across the political spectrum. Now, I suppose you've talked about this already. Will you be, for example, you mentioned there was a lot of resistance within more conservative thinking. And there was Owen Paterson this morning on the Today programme saying that climate change predictions are greatly exaggerated. Is it best to target the more moderate conservatives in this way? Are you going to have much effect with the Owen Patersons of this world?
Yeah, I mean, Owen Paterson is a curious character in a way, because he strongly self-identifies as a sort of man of the country. You know, he that's the way that he puts himself forward, of the countryside.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's got the story about how he had a pet badger as a kid or something like that. And so ironically, he's been implicated in you know, the making probably the wrong decision about the badger coal as a minister in charge of DEFRA. But In terms of climate change, he was always very ambiguous when he was in post. It was only after he left that he came out all guns blazing, saying that, you know, he did doubt some of the mainstream findings of climate science. And you have to think, step back and ask, why do people who say they doubt the the findings of mainstream science. What is it they're actually doubting? Most people, not everybody, but most people, including, I'd say, you know, myself, perhaps you, like most people really, are not experts on climate science. You know, I don't read new peer-reviewed publications on climate science because it's not my area of expertise. I'm not sure I'd be able to understand it any more than I could understand any other complex area of science. So all of us are having to go on, you know, second-hand, sometimes third-hand knowledge about what the reality of climate science is telling us. And it's only when we get to the point where we've got such an overwhelming consensus from every science academy in the world that climate change is real and poses dangerous risks, and that urgent action needs to be taken of some kind, that we feel comfortable accepting that as just a fact. You don't need to keep going back and looking. We accept it as a fact, but some people don't. And it seems from the research that's been done that the reason people don't is not because they've found out something about the science that other people don't know. For the most part, they don't have any more or less idea about the science than anyone else does. But what they don't necessarily like is the implications of acting on climate change. Yeah. So if you're somebody who strongly believes that the government shouldn't interfere in people's lives, or if you strongly believe that the market should be left to regulate itself without any legislation or anything like that, you're strongly of a free market persuasion, then climate change is pretty threatening to your worldview. Naomi Klein has just released a new book, which COIN actually did the launch of in Oxford, which is a really interesting read. And she says in there that she thinks that actually the right of politics has takes climate change more seriously in some senses than a lot of people on the left who accept the science but maybe haven't fully engaged with what the implications are. She argues that a particular type of or quite extreme right-leaning politics in the US really, the sort of far end of the Republican Party who fully deny climate change, or they deny there's any risk associated with it. The reason they do it is they can see clearly that if they accept that those risks are there, that it's going to have real knock-on effects on some things that they care passionately about, which is, you know, government not interfering in the regulation of industry and things like that. So she argues that they get it, all right. That's why they're denying climate change in the first place, because they can see what the implications are. And it is hard to imagine how we could tackle a problem as diffuse and as something that touches on so many different aspects of people's lives as climate change without some kind of, you know, coordinated regulatory processes. Doesn't mean that that's all there is to it, but it does seem difficult to imagine that we could do it without those processes. And so that's kind of what's going on really with the link between, you know, conservatism and scepticism, is people work backwards from the policies to tackle climate change that they don't necessarily like the sound of, or that sound like the kind of things that they should oppose, and they work backwards from there to cast doubt on the underlying science. So someone like Owen Paterson, going back to the question, I mean, it's clear that he really doesn't like renewable energy, and he objects to it from a number of perspectives, but he says, you know, it ruins the kind of state of the countryside that he loves so much. You often do hear that from people maybe on more on the centre right who talk about the sort of aesthetics of wind farms, things like that. But work that we've done before at COIN has tried to say, okay, is it the case that climate change and the centre right are completely incompatible, or is it that we could think about this issue in a different way that wouldn't maybe get people's backs up in as you begin that conversation? It's not that you're telling them something completely different. Like, you still have to engage with the reality of climate change at some point, but that conversation starts in a different way. So that instead of saying this is about global justice and the crushing of corporate power and the redistribution of wealth, which is that's a strong part of the climate change narrative that's developed internationally. Climate change kind of came of age as quite a left wing issue. If instead of that you talk about wanting to protect the green and pleasant land of England and to hand on an environment and a country in a state that's fit for the next generation, as the last generation gave to you, in that sense of kind of heritage and pride in your national identity, and that climate change actually threatens, you know, that green and pleasant land that you love so much, the effect of flooding is going to really decimate places that are beautiful and that we want to look after. Like, you start the conversation in a slightly different way, and you've opened up that idea that actually, no, this is something that conservatives care about. We can see that climate change applies to things that you care about as well. It's not just something for the left. And, you know, I think like those kinds of ideas of different language and different frames that for sure are not enough on their own to suddenly flip the whole debate. But I think that they are an important part of the mix, because they do, you know, the language that we use to think about these issues really does shape how we think about them.
So this is presumably what you mean by reframing the debate, in a sense that it's appealing to what people can relate to in a more positive way, talking to people's values and what's important to them.
Yeah, exactly that. It's about speaking to the diverse values that people have, and finding the sort of overlap between where people are, or like building a bridge between those values and what you might call like the values of a more sustainable society. So a lot of the work that COIN does, it draws on the work of decades of social psychology looking at how different values are related to each other. And there's a certain cluster of values which are called self-transcendent values, you know, values that transcend the self and speak to the interests of others, like altruism, concern for the welfare of others. And these values are consistently shown to predict, you know, positive concern about climate change, interest in environmental issues, whether people actually take part in environmental campaigns or behaviours themselves. And so we always try and make sure that when we're talking about reframing messages about climate change, on the one hand, it's absolutely crucial to be thinking, who are you talking to? Like, that's never a bad step. Who are you talking to? What are they interested in? What are their values? Where are they coming from? What's their perspective? What are their aspirations and their ideas about the future and where they want to be and progress and what they want the world to be like? But at the same time, you're also trying to map back across to these underlying sustainable values, these self-transcending values that ultimately need to be kind of promoted and built up in society if we're serious about tackling climate change. Because although you can say to people, and some, you know, some campaigns and initiatives have done this, although you can say to people, well, you know, you should install this insulation for your house because it will save you money on your energy bills. Although that might well be a really good thing, and I'm not saying for a second that people shouldn't be saving money on their energy bills, I think that's a good thing. But if your motivation for doing it is to save money, then are you going to take part in another energy saving initiative which doesn't save you money? Or are you going to just think of yourself as the sort of person that does things because they want to save money? Perhaps, you know, it's speaking to more kind of wealth, materialistic values, which we know are ultimately opposed to people being interested in climate change. That's what the research shows. So there's a kind of broader set of work around these ideas, which is not just on climate change, like how do charities campaign on poverty and equality and all these different issues, called the common cause approach, which basically just applies that logic, says there's a kind of common theme to lots of charities' work, which you know, has to do with wanting to solve what they call bigger than self problems that can't be solved by appealing to people's sort of selfish nature, and that anytime any charity or any other organization goes outside of that and starts to appeal to people's selfish nature, they're actually making it harder for themselves in the future or other organizations to do their work, because actually you're trying to stoke that kind of boiling pot of civic responsibility and collective well-being in the medium to long term. And although it might be a quick win to appeal to more materialistic values, it doesn't actually get us all that far in the bigger picture.
So what in a sense you're saying, this is a moral issue. Are you saying that the evidence suggests that people respond more to appeals to ideas of justice and fairness rather than self-interest?
I think the reality is that people respond to for a variety of motivations, and you have to reflect on you know, your own experience or people you know to think that most of us care about the welfare of other people that we love, and our friends and our family, and that's quite altruistically motivated. We care about, you know, unfair treatment for the people that we care about. At the same time, we probably are also quite attached to some material possessions of some kind. You know, we're also in for a good deal when we see one. So it's not the case that like people are either altruistic or they're completely materialistic. Like we all have a variety of motivations, I think it's fair to say. But the question is, when it comes to something like climate change, what are we trying to do? Is this like a one-shot problem where we've got one opportunity and one message to convince as many people as possible to take part in one behavior? Because if it was like that, then I would say just go for the thing that's most likely to work the quickest. And that could well be telling people they're going to save 50 quid. But it seems to me that climate change is very much not like that. So a good example is something like the Green Deal policy, which the government has at the moment to try and insulate a lot of homes, make them warmer, make them cozier, make them use less energy, and to help bring down the country's carbon emissions, which we're legally obligated to do. But to read about the Green Deal, you don't find out about many of those things. You don't hear the word climate change or carbon emissions or about making homes cozier and things like that. What you hear is that you can save money on your energy bills if you get this insulation installed. It's very much presented as an economic incentive to take part in a particular behavior. Just in like I said before, it's not a bad thing for people to be saving money on energy bills. You know, there's a strong argument that a lot of people are facing really energy bills that are too high at the moment, and that to me is a kind of distinct issue that they should be lower across the board. But the question is whether that's a good motivation for saving energy, because you know the next time that something has to happen, the Green Deal isn't the end of the story; it's the beginning of the story. We're going to have another 20 policies like this before we get anywhere near our targets under the Climate Change Act. And so we haven't moved the discourse any further forward by telling people that they'll save 50 quid if they insulate their homes, or they'll eventually break even on their energy bills. You know, it's not that that's a bad thing, and that can be part of the argument somewhere in there. But we've got to be thinking when these are valuable, precious opportunities for starting a national conversation about climate change, and they're being squandered, I think, at the moment from the government's perspective, by just avoiding talking about the issue altogether, where actually we could be sending out teams of community-based, you know, volunteers, people who are known local tradespeople, who can start to actually just build this sense that there's this enormous challenge that we're facing together, but everyone's doing it. You know, it starts to put into place this idea that it's socially normal for people to be insulating their homes. And why are they doing it? Well, it's great, it saves money, but also we're doing it because, you know, we need to cut our carbon emissions because it's the fair thing to do. It's going to make our country safer and more secure and produce a kind of better climate for us all to be living in. And those kinds of narratives are really just absent, I think, most of the time from the discourse around energy policy. And although everyone, on the one hand, people don't talk about climate change, everyone talks about energy, but those two things are so dislocated. You know, when you reflect on that, it's actually quite bizarre, really.
Yeah, and I suppose this ties into the third idea for re-inspiring public support, that the nurturing of communities of conviction. You know, this is not just a problem that we face as individuals, but we can tackle it a lot better if we can get together.
Yeah. Well, so this, the kind of phrase, you know, communities of conviction, I'm borrowing from some of George's work and something that he goes into a bit more detail about in his new book. So part of what George did for his book was to speak to a lot of different communities in the US, but including evangelical Christian communities who I think he was interested in the first place because they have an unusual relationship to climate change, in that I think they're quite evenly split between people who are strongly, because of the links with the kind of conservative right in America, strongly opposed to climate change, and then also people who are quite active in promoting the idea that you know, of creation care, and that Christians are stewards of on God's earth. And I think that George came to the realization as he spoke to more and more people from evangelical communities that they had something, and I think it's common to lots of faith groups, but it perhaps used to be more common in plenty of secular groups as well, things like trade unions, which are, you know, have been weakened so much over the last 20 years, of this kind of common purpose, literally physical spaces to congregate in, to affirm beliefs that you hold so that you realize you don't hold them on your own, in contrast to something like climate change, where on the one hand, it's the ultimate collective action problem. On the other hand, nobody's talking about it, and there's nowhere to have your beliefs about climate change, whatever they might be, affirmed or challenged or engaged with. You know, there's very, very few forums for that to take place at all. And I think the point that rams that home for me is there was a recent survey by the Energy Climate Intelligence Unit, which is a new organisation that's been set up to sort of combat some of the misinformation in the media on climate change. And they commissioned a poll which asked members of the public to estimate how many people they thought, or what proportion of the public they thought supported renewables or opposed renewables, things like that. So it was kind of asking people to guess what the social consensus was on various topics. And they found these really striking disconnects. So although if you look at the polling data going back, you know, 10 years now, you see like 70-80% of the population in nationally representative polls will say they support renewable energy, solar, wind, whatever. It's a little bit different at a local scale where there are disputes over where these things should go. But in general, the principle of renewable energy is widely endorsed. Okay. In this poll where they asked people to estimate how many people do you think actually support renewables, I think only 5% got the kind of right answer of 75-80% of people actually support it. The rest of people drastically underestimated. They thought maybe only 50% support renewables, 50% against. So, you know, what is that? Maybe it's a function of a false kind of balance in the media. Maybe climate skeptic voices get more attention. But also, I think it says to me that people just we have no idea what other people think about these things. We don't talk to each other about it. How would I know what my neighbours think about climate change? I wouldn't dare to bring it up. As lots of people, I think, wouldn't, you know, because it's something that you're worried that it might be seen as you know, preachy, or you're kind of moaning at them to do something. You know, you don't know whether someone might be climate skeptical, might want to argue with you. It's just kind of got to the point where we face this, you know, overwhelmingly collective problem in a completely atomized and private way, where unless you're in a kind of quite specialist network of people that talk about climate change, you don't talk about it at all.
Yeah. We actually want to participate, the Middle Way Society, in a small way. We're actually running a weekend retreat in February on the Middle Way and the environment. So, if anyone's listening to this and is interested, then contact us, because we want to do exactly what you're talking about, really.
Great stuff, yeah.
Anyway, on that point, my final question, Adam, well, we've talked a little bit about the middle, especially earlier on, but what is your understanding of the middle way, and how might it relate to what we've been talking about today?
I think the thing that sort of stands out to me about the ideas and the philosophy of taking a middle way is that it's kind of pluralistic in a way. It's not something that sort of says there's a particular path set in stone, and there's certainly not particular extreme paths at either end set in stone. And I think that climate change up until now has been quite an oppositional fight. And we hear this language, I slip into using this language all the time, between, you know, skeptics and non-skeptics. The reality is, although there are some extremes at either end of the scale, maybe like 10% who flat out deny that climate change is a problem, and 10% who are extremely committed and live by their values in a way. The vast majority, the rest of us, you know, are in the middle. We're kind of compromised by the things that we do, unintentionally or otherwise. We feel kind of guilty about the fact that we probably, you know, overconsume relative to how much we think we should. And actually, the answer to something as complicated and messy as climate change is going to be complicated and messy, I think. Like, it's going to be, we'll muddle through in our answer to climate change in a way that democratic societies always do. And there was a slogan that came out of the recent big march for climate change in New York, the People's Climate March, which related to the title of Naomi Klein's latest book, which is This Changes Everything. And the slogan that came out of that march, which seemed apparently to sort of emerge quite organically, no one seems to know who the originator of the phrase was, but the phrase was that to change everything, we need everyone. And I think that just, you know, neatly encapsulates the idea that we do have to have a real diversity of approaches and understandings to climate change. Some of them I'm not going to like, some of them you're not going to like. But as long as they're heading in broadly the right direction, with a kind of, you know, at a very general level, we're heading towards a sustainable society as defined by, you know, avoiding the risks of dangerous climate change, keeping within a certain amount of global warming, then the society that has solved climate change, in inverted commas, is probably going to be just as messy and complicated as the one that hasn't solved it yet, you know, but hopefully we will have at least have done that.
Yeah, wise words there, yeah, Adam. Anyway, thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been fascinating.
Yeah, thank you very much, Barry. No, it's good to. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you and including us in your podcast.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.